Hello, can you hear me at the back? Yes. Welcome to the lands of the Wurundjeri people. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge that we're having this on their lands, which they occupied and managed for several thousands of years. I'd like to offer my respects to their elders and people, both past, present and future. I'd also like to thank the Australian German Climate College and our Melbourne Uni for providing this theatre for us tonight. I'm Rob Gardner and I help to organise these meetings for the ATA. We have a monthly meeting and we alternate between the different universities, usually RMIT and Swinburne. And details will be available if people want to come to those later on. I'll briefly talk about ATA, and Ross Garner will briefly talk about Australian German Climate College, but we won't go on very long because we have an excellent presenter here tonight, of Audrey, and we want to give her as much time as possible. So the ATA was formed in 1980, and it was one of the first groups looking at sustainability, and we cover sustainability in all its forms. It's a not-for-profit organisation with over 6,500 members, and we are well known for producing two magazines, which you saw at the entrance, Renew and Sanctuary. We also have an advisory service available for members, and you can buy tranches of time as well. We have a very big lobbying and research area, so we're quite well known for that and often appear on ABC Rio on Saturday mornings. The other helpers for me tonight is Chris and Peter, who helped to organise these meetings. So if you want to know anything about future meetings, please speak to us afterwards. And I think that's all about ATA, and I'll pass over to Ross.
Thanks, Rob. Warm welcome to everyone. I'd just like to say, to tell you a little bit about the Australia-German College of Climate and Energy Transition. It's been going a couple of years, and it's designed to have Australian and European scholars with interests in climate and energy share ideas, share projects, learn together about the very big challenge that we all have to address in the period ahead, the challenge of moving to zero emissions in the economy, with the electricity and energy sectors being particularly important in that. No one's got all the knowledge. No one can do all of the innovation themselves. And the partnership between universities and research institutes in Europe and Australia can help us all make progress. The centre of the college in Australia is at the University of Melbourne, where Malte Meinhausen has been doing a sterling job building the base here. And in Germany, there are five major collaborating institutions, but the German side doesn't see themselves as just making a national contribution. They're helping us established networks throughout Europe, and that's been tremendously valuable for the work that we do. It's currently a bit over 30 PhD students, drawn roughly half from around Australia, half from Europe, a strong German base in Europe, but students coming from the other European countries as well. Really first-rate students doing excellent work, and we're all learning from the PhD level work that they're doing. It's part of the normal programs for people associated with the college at the European end to spend some time here, and vice versa, people here spending some time in German and other European institutions. One recent initiative that's very exciting is the Climate and Energy Transition Hub, which is a collaboration, again, between Germany and German and Australian institutions, bringing in other Europeans on the German side, but focusing very particularly on the challenge of the transition to zero emissions. And we were delighted recently at the on the occasion of the Hamburg G20 meeting chaired by by Chancellor Merkel, that the Australian Prime Minister and the German Chancellor jointly announced substantial support for the hub for joint research that would push out the frontiers on a whole range of issues associated with transition to a zero emissions economy. There's a lot of engineering at both ends, and we've got a lot to learn, of course, from German and European institutions on the engineering, but it goes way beyond that. It's the economics, it's the governance of energy systems, it's the international politics of carbon negotiations. There's work in all of these areas represented, and we've identified a large number of particular projects with different groups in Australia and Europe working on them, funded jointly by Australian institutions, with the Australian government making an initial contribution, Victorian government talking to us about helping, various private sector contributions as well. German side, a very large contribution from the federal government and other, and the German private sector contributing as well. For the Australian side, a particular focus is how we can make the most of what is an extraordinarily rich renewable energy resource in Australia. A few years ago, I gave a lecture initially at the University of Adelaide and then here about Australia as the energy superpower of the low-carbon world economy. And the theme there was that the developed country with by far the richest renewable resources should be, if we do things properly, be the developed country with the advantage in low energy costs and therefore the natural home for energy-intensive industries. Well, we're not that at the moment. Because we haven't managed things very well. There's uncertainty about policy, which puts up the supply price of investment and inhibits the transition. We've resisted the innovation that's necessary to integrate the new technologies into our old systems in ways that minimise cost and improve our reliability. But we'll get there. I chair the international board of the Climate and Energy Transition Hub. The deputy chair is the president of the famous Climate Institute in Potsdam, the Potsdam Institute, John Schonhuber, one of the world's truly eminent climate scientists. I was delighted when John told me a couple of years ago that he'd been asked by the Pope to advise him on climate science, and the quality of that advice is reflected in Pope Francis's encyclical, Laudato Si. And we've got enthusiastic collaborators at the German end, and we're looking forward to rich progress through that collaboration. At the Australian end, it's not just the University of Melbourne. Our partners are the Australian National University. I'm pleased to say that the two universities at which I've spent my professional life are both working together on this, and we're also bringing in collaboration with a range of other Australian universities, so it's becoming a truly national effort. So I look forward to you taking an interest in the work of the College of Climate and Energy, and we're delighted to share this occasion with the ATO, and we're all looking forward to learn from one of Australia's great assets in managing the energy transition, Audrey Zimmerman, who has already demonstrated that she's got the qualities of analytic strength and leadership to help us to start making the changes that we put off for too long. Thank you.
Thank you, Ross. My name is Helen Milliser and I'm the president of the ATA. It's a wonderful time that we are here. Certainly it is dynamic and challenging. It's the perfect storm in a way, because in a way when energy demand equals energy supply, we have to come up with some significant initiatives. So it provides us significant opportunity for real change. At the ATA, with a membership base which is growing of 6,500 households plus more, we run some outstanding programs for mainstream Australians as well as for our members. We have branches in every state. We have expertise amongst our members that truly would be rivaled in any professional industry organisation. And we are also undergoing change ourselves. We'll be going through change internally, and we will be reaching in the coming years to a far larger mainstream audience. Some of the thoughts or things that we're doing might be, as people have seen, was a Stanmore House Day on the weekend. And for those of you who got to any of our 200 plus households that were open across the country, along with 20,000 other people, you would have seen some astonishing initiatives by individuals making changes in their own lives. Now, these are people who believe that sustainability equals comfort, equals efficiency. It's not about the hair shirt living, it's about a comfortable, sustainable future. And so we recognise at the ATA that this is actually not just the right of a few, but really the right of many. In fact, it's a right for all. In the 21st century, in a wealthy country like Australia, it is really absurd that we have houses that rate between 1 and 2 star for efficiency. We have more people who die in their homes because of heat and cold than during the moderate times of the year. That truly is a criminal situation. We have only 10 certified passive houses in this country, when there are some 40,000 around the world. We have only one state in this country that has disclosure on housing energy efficiency upon point of sale. We don't even make it easy for people to know what they are buying. Can you imagine if we had a car sales system where you could buy a car but you weren't allowed to drive it or know how many kilometres were left on the clock? It's comparable. We also have the most inefficient vehicle system in this country, where we have more pollution per vehicle than in any other country in the OECD. That's an abomination as well. So we have significant challenges and we have significant opportunities, but there's absolutely no doubt that through the ATA and in conjunction with other organisations, we can achieve that change that is necessary for a sustainable 21st century. So it's absolutely wonderful that we welcome today Audrey Zimmerman, who has extensive experience from offshore, which is what we need in this country to sometimes shine the light into the dark places that we have. Audrey Jordan joined AEMO as Chief Executive Officer in only March this year, and she's certainly walked into the lion's den, hasn't she? Thankfully, she has extensive international experience in public, private, and not-for-profit energy sectors. She was the Chair of the New York State Public Service Commission, which looked after everything, including gas, electricity, water, cable as well, and steam utilities, so no mean feat. And prior to that, she was the Chief Executive President and Chief Operating Officer for PJM, which is a system operator for some 14 states across the eastern part of the US. She's also founder of company energy companies, so she's had extensive experience. So hopefully she'll bring all of this to bear and she'll wave her magic wand, talk great common sense, and our leaders will listen. No mean feat. I hope I haven't set the bar too high over it. So she's a great asset to us in Australia, and we're absolutely delighted to have her here today. I thank Rob and the team from the Melbourne branch and also the German Climate Institute for coordinating today, because there's absolutely no doubt that we can't achieve this alone. We have to do this together, and we need a suite of measures. And I'm sure that Audrey is surely cognizant of that and will be able to speak and enlighten us. At the end of her presentation, we will be taking questions, so there'll be an opportunity for further discussion then. So don't leave and save your questions till then. So with that, may I welcome Audrey.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for coming. And, you know, I'm not going to speak for an hour. I hope no one's too disappointed about that. And I do hope this is more of a conversation. So, you know, from my perspective, this is one of these audiences where I'm not going to introduce you to the terms around how the power system works or things like that. So I'd like to just start off with some givens, right? So one is the technology innovation that we're seeing now around the falling cost of solar, the falling cost of wind, consumer preference, other technologies that are allowing us to use power more efficiently, as well as big data, are all driving fundamental change in this industry. So if you go across all the OECD countries, I'm going to guess if we were sitting in New York where they have Climate Change Week going on right now, you'd be hearing this conversation over and over again, is that this industry is in massive transformation. And for where people used to think about the fact that you could be, you can't hear me in the back? Okay. No? Is that bad enough?
Do you want to try the handheld
instead? Oh, my God. How's that? He's threatened me with that. So it's the conversation I'm sure is being repeated over and over again in New York is the industry is going through massive transformation. And so I'm going to start this conversation with what I think is happening in Australia, but actually is happening, I think, across all the OECD countries, which is we had power systems that were built post-World War II that were built at a time where central station power plants were a very efficient way of delivering energy as all our economies were really becoming increasingly electrified. And that these massive power systems, we used to call it the sort of major engineering feat of the 20th century, where you had these huge integrated systems, made a lot of sense for economies of scale, growing economies, all those things. But things have definitely changed. So one thing that's changing is the fact that you're seeing falling cost of solar and wind, and batteries, and other technologies. The other thing that's changing is consumer preference. And of course, and then the other third piece that's changing is energy policy. But the other piece that I think is becoming more and more of reality and a recognition is that where I would say, you know, those of us who grew up and remember, you know, life small is beautiful and all that, where there was a sort of idea, there's a dichotomy because of, between an environmentalist and a business person, that the triple bottom line was just a dream, is that that's simply not true anymore. So massive companies, large companies, old companies, really saying that economic sustainability and environmental sustainability are one and the same. It is really good for the bottom line to be efficient. And so that is changing. So not only do we have individual preferences, but I think there's a recognition. So I'm going to sort of start as a given that in this, particularly in this audience, I'm not going to debate whether the energy industry is in a transformation. It's in a transformation. Solar and wind are falling. I think they're probably a grid parity in many parts of the world. And certainly if I look at AEMO, we have 21,000 megawatts of connection requests, all solar and wind. We have 90,000 installations of PV every month across Australia. So this, this rate of change is faster than we've ever seen in this industry. And it's something that, frankly, for our industry, the power industry, and I would say the energy industry as a whole, really, really been an interesting change. So where people used to think about change in this industry happening in decades, they're really seeing rapid changes in months. And so CEOs across in most of the companies I talk to are actually now seeing this future as something that may be the next person's job to deal with, as it's their job to deal with, if they're going to create healthy companies. And so we really have to go, it's not a question of whether, it's a question of how. And the how is how do we make this transition in an efficient way. So one of the things that Dr. Fingold and I talked about is people miss a lot in what he said, is the objective has to be a sane transition, because the transition is occurring, and what we need to do is guide that in a way that doesn't create too much disruption for the economy. And so a lot of the recommendations were about how do we make this transition in a way that's efficient and effective. So that's what I'll talk about today. So I think about it in these terms as the energy system. We always talk about it as a system. It is a system, but it's actually a system of systems, and it's multiple systems. So you know, our first job at AEMO is reliability and security. And so when we think about the system, we really think about the power system. So one of the things that has to change, and we think about a lot, is we're going from a power system that was synchronous, dominated by thermal resources, that provide inertia, that provide frequency, that provided voltage, provided all the things that are required to make a power system work, to resources that don't necessarily have that capability. And that the system we're operating today is much different than the system we operated historically. So before, where you would basically have thermal resources that you could turn on and turn off, and demand itself was fairly predictable, that's changing. So as we have more higher penetrations of solar, we're seeing demand, for example, last weekend in South Australia, demand was 800 megawatts, 100 megawatts less than it was last year from photovoltaic installation. But when that sun stops shining and that demand starts coming up, we don't need it. And so understanding how to meet those kind of variabilities and the types of resources we need to do to manage that is one of the things we're thinking about. So we, the AAMC issued a rulemaking this week, a set of rules, I should say, that we had asked for about how do we maintain frequency on the system. So as everyone knows from last summer, the system blackout that occurred in South Australia, and we see it now a lot, is there many times we have so much wind, not enough demand, and the system can't manage it. So we actually have to turn on gas units during those hours in order to avoid losing the system. Well, that's not really what any of us want. So we have to design the capability to manage through that. It's not a question of a preference for one fuel type or not. It's a preference for making sure the system is still a physical system, still needs inertia, still has frequency, still has voltage, all those issues that we have to solve for. So we're dealing with those issues. The other question is the issue that you saw us raise in our advice to the government last week, was around what I would call, we said dispatchability in the United States, we talk about it as operating reserves. It's the capability for the system to respond. Again, it's not just it's maintaining the system, but it's also saying if the wind stops blowing, something has to increase if customers are using power. How do we do that? So it's having a system that can be responsive. That could be through storage, that could be through hydro, could be through demand response, but it's having those tools. So what, and the third thing that we're dealing with is predictability. So I started in this industry in 1988, and one of the things that we used to sort of always guide and look at our operators to do is what we call PJM perfect dispatch. Was their ability to use a learning algorithm to say, well, if it's going to be 20 degrees and it's a Wednesday and it's during a period of time where people are at work, we should be able to look back and figure out what the demand is going to be. And what I rated my operators on was how good they were at being able to forecast so that we were running the right units and that we weren't running too much or too little. So we called it perfect dispatch because they would, a day before, so today we'd be planning for tomorrow. Well, guess what? That doesn't work anymore. Because, you know, cloud cover can change. Everything can change. So every year it's a little bit like it's not Groundhog Day. It's actually a totally different day. And so the tools that we need, and this is where we need the universities to help us, is to create these learning algorithms, these neural networks, these very smart AI, to start dealing with all the variations that can happen in a system. So a lot of what you're clear about the email doing is actually saying these resources can work, but we have to be a lot more sophisticated, a lot more granular, a lot more precise, because that's the way the world is headed, so that we can signal to the market exactly what kind of capabilities the system needs to have, because the system is still a system. So that's one thing that's changing. The other thing that we're going to manage through the transition is moving from a power system that was one way to truly two way, and that's really the reason, one of the major reasons I was so excited about coming here and thought of this huge opportunity we have in Australia. So something that happened in this electric industry in the last portion of the 20th century and the first portion of this century is that generation became more and more competitive. So we created markets like AEMO where generators were not owned by incumbent monopoly. They were separately owned and we were bidding and trading electricity. And so that created a lot more efficiency because what we're doing is maybe managing the resources better. One of the things, though, that we have an even better opportunity to do is actually using demand. So the system was built up on the idea that demand was inelastic, which it largely was, and that therefore you always had enough resources not only to meet the demand, but if the biggest resource fell over, you can immediately turn on something else and meet the demand, because the demand wasn't going to go away. It was pretty inelastic. Everyone was going to not change. Well, that's changed, obviously. But what's more importantly is that we can use distributed resources. People call it the democratization of energy, where we can use rooftop solar, we can use storage, we can use electric vehicles, we can use hot water heaters, we can use actually smart thermostats to actually think about how to make the system more efficient. Because one of the things that is sort of a hallmark of the power system is because electricity is the only product that really readily can't be stored, it has to be consumed and produced simultaneously, is you always needed a lot of reserves because just in case something broke. You couldn't put it in a water tower or a tank or anything like that. You had to have a generator that was ready to go. Well, what if instead of creating more generation, we use demand? What if we can use these resources that are sitting behind the meter and you're putting in solar and you're putting in storage, you have an electric vehicle, or you can store energy in your hot water heater and use that at night. How do we use those better so that rather than building another peaking unit to just be there just in case, and transmission and distribution, we start to use demand better, so we're using the resources and making the system more productive. So the major innovation that's now occurring is that rather than thinking about rooftop solar and these things as a threat to the power system, actually they're a new customer group. And the role of the power system is to aggregate and optimize those to drive productivity throughout the entire system. And the value then is saying that what we're changing in the power system is we're going from something where you had a bulk power system, where you had generators meeting demand, and demand, the usage itself being fairly passive and I would say dumb, to smart demand, where it's actually responding to a price. I'm not going to turn people into day traders for energy, but if you set your thermostat, and you have a Nest thermostat, and the Nest thermostat is reading a price, and you've told your provider that if it goes above a certain amount, you can turn my thermostat up a couple degrees, I don't care. You can you can circulate my pump, you can circulate my hot water heater, all of a sudden, that's 700, 800 megawatts. Two power plants, just sitting in the cities that we can use. And that drives value. It helps reduce price. It obviously helps reduce emissions. So there's nothing, it's all about productivity, which is when you think about digitalization. That's what digitalization does. It provides that productivity. So for us, the big thing about AEMO is saying, we want to make the power system more productive. We want to make it more efficient, which means we want to make it two-way. And we want to use these distributed networks. We can even use what we call microgrids, where you have small embedded systems where people are putting storage and solar together and they're serving their needs to actually drive productivity. The good thing about that is, one is we'll create more competition. Secondly, we'll reduce price. Third, we'll demonstrate that environmental and sustainable outcomes are not quite consistent with economic outcomes. And the other thing is that we're going to grow capacity and capability throughout our energy economy that I think, in addition to some of the things that we've always done historically in Australia, will become the new energy economy. Because the things we're talking about here are the things that people are talking about everywhere. But one of the other pieces that I find terrifically exciting and you know, one part of my resume that often isn't talked about is I started my professional career after university as a U.S. a Peace Corps volunteer living in Chad, Africa, where people didn't have access to energy. And so energy access is a big, important thing for me. And so if we can develop these capabilities of how to use these resources better, there's still 2 billion people in the world without access to energy. They're not going to think they're building big power systems. They're going to build microsystems. Why not have Australia lead in that? Because our system is really a series of microsystems. We don't have, like the United States and Europe, where you have people all over. We have really a lot of urbanization. So to me, there's this other piece of where the technology innovation is going to occur in this industry, and why not have Australia lead in that as well. So it's all good. So power system is one thing that we're looking to change. The other are the market systems that go with it. And that's really the fact that we're saying if we are going to use demands, again, think about AEMO's role. Our job as the power system operator is to keep supply and demand in balance. That's the way it always works. So if you're using more electricity, I either have to turn on a generator or I have to find a consumer who says, oh, well, I have a battery charged up. I'll use that instead. And for us, as a system operator, it has the same value. Because all we're trying to do is keep it in balance. So if somebody is able to manage demand, and we use that instead of using supply, that gives us an opportunity to actually compensate them. Because what we're trying to do is, again, drive efficiency throughout the system. And for a system operator, we want to take the lowest cost resource to drive the outcome we want to achieve, which is system balance. And so to us, it's the same value as a system operator. To you as a consumer, it could be even better value, because what drives prices in the power system is demand. And if we're able to reduce demand, that drives down, it's sort of the law of commons, it's good for everybody. So that's one of the things why, so this year, one of the things that we worked on with ARENA was to say, how do we create a demand management market in Australia? Because there's a huge opportunity here. And I had a chance to visit with the distribution utility in Queensland. They're already working with their customers. They use the pool pumps, they use hot water heaters and thermostats, and they manage demand without, you know, there's been a lot of press on this, and I just hope you guys, it's not turning out lights. It's circulating things. You don't even notice it. You haven't recognized it. It's taking your air conditioner, turning it off for 15 minutes, and turning it back on. And so it's those kinds of automation that makes sense. In Queensland, they said that they have about 800 to 900 megawatts of that capacity just sitting there. They're using it to manage the reliability of the distribution system. But again, that's 2 big power plants. Just by using energy smarter in a way that is undetectable by people. So it's that kind of stuff we want to unleash. The other today, I was also at ARENA, has what they call these A-Labs, where they bring in innovators and they come up with their ideas. And what I love going to that, and sort of one of the reasons I think it's always fortunate for people who get to work at universities, you see these really smart people with these great ideas. And they just, you know, they just need the encouragement and the capability to bring it to fruition. So the other thing that we're doing in the markets, and this is the ARENA piece, is we're going to do these demonstrations. And so Joe Witters is sitting here. We set up an innovation center at AEMO. And the idea is this. We built this industry on a very fully regulated piece. We never did things unless we did them through tariffs. We would have these long proceedings and utilities would beg us for change, and it would take years before anything changed, because we were all risk averse. Utilities were risk averse, regulators were risk averse, and customers just didn't, you know, weren't particularly engaged. Well, that's changing. And so one of the things that we have to think about as technology is changing is the markets need to allow proof of concepts. We need more innovation. We need to allow experimentation in sandboxes before we take it, because it is a real-time system. So one of the other things we're looking at to do in the markets is more and more of these proof of concepts, where we're using communities to say, well, how would it? We get a total community engaged, so what we call virtual power plants, where you assemble and aggregate a whole bunch of small solar and storage, and suddenly, from our perspective, looks like a big power plant. How do we get customers engaged, looking at different pricing mechanisms? How do we use systems better, get better algorithms written? So it's all those types of things that we think, I think, first of all, IMO's doing, and we're going to reuse it as a way, because rather than trying to get things engineered to the nth degree, it's actually some form of adaptive development that we've really done in other industries and we can do here. So that's the other piece we're working on. And the other elements of the markets is better pricing, better, more accurate pricing, so people can engage in the markets. The third system that's really critical is the regulatory system. And of course, that was what I used to do. So this is not an emo, but this is how we have to think about it, is that business models are changing. And we can't expect to use the same regulatory formulas as we've done historically and expect to have different outcomes. So thinking about, for example, and this is to me one of the critical pieces, the role of the distribution utility. You used to think of the distribution utility as that entity who just delivered energy to your meter. That's all they did. You know, it's not like a small thing. It's a big thing. It's really complicated to run these systems. But now you have these consumer groups, you, who are putting solar on your roof and storage and are becoming prosumers. And so now it becomes the question is, what is the role of the distribution utility to enable these kind of markets, to provide you the data and information necessary, the services, so that if you're investing in these resources, they can be used in the most efficient way to manage the grid. So understanding that historically, regulation was all about building capital, not necessarily incenting customers to really go off the grid. So you're going to create this tension, right, between the traditional utility mindset and you as a customer who might want to consume less and be more independent. So the way to change that is really change the model and start thinking about how can the utility make money really from not building distribution, not building a substation, but enabling efficiency. And so things that are being discussed in Australia, certainly things we did in New York, are all about changing that economic model, because you can't expect a utility to embrace selling less megawatts. It would be like telling a car dealer, you should love this, you're not going to sell cars anymore, it's going to be good for you. So we have to change that model. So that's the other piece that has to change, is that. And also, again, allowing innovation. With this level of change and rapidity of change, you can't simply expect people to sort of come up with a solution. They need an opportunity to try things in a safe space. And I think we're seeing that in the AER and in regulatory changes in Australia, is allowing that innovation. Now, there are two things that I think can't change and have to be thought through as we make this transition. One is the social welfare aspects of energy. So we still have a very much of a major issue around ensuring affordability. And you know, for some, many consumers, thankfully, energy, even with prices, I know, going high here, you look at your overall income, most consumers are not making choices, but many consumers have to. And so it is an essential service that is not going to go away. And so we have to think about how do we provide that social good. Some of the things that people are thinking about in this industry is, it's a difficult issue, is that, and we saw this in New York, where historically, and I'll put this in Aussie dollars, historically, the average income in New York that put solar on the rooftop was about $250,000 a year. That was the people who were putting solar on their roof. People who were making $60,000 a year weren't putting solar on the roof. A lot of them didn't have roofs because they lived in multi-unit buildings, right? So the problem then becomes, if there's grid defection, but you still have to manage the grid, the cost of this grid, this network, which is older, is being put more and more on those who are left behind. So it creates a difficulty. One is they don't have access to the new innovation. And the second is they're going to be paying more and more for the electricity because those costs won't go away. They're socialized, right? And they stay the same. So we have to think through in this transition, how do we make sure that the boats are lifted for everybody, that there's access and there's business models, so you're not creating this diseconomy, and which makes it more expensive. So it's those kind of pieces, I would say, we're talking about affordability, a lot of studies about it, but understanding that electricity is a common good in many ways, and that we have to preserve that commonality it remains important. The other thing that I think that it will not change is the financial system. So one of the things that's very important as we think about this transition is the fact that these are massive investments, very expensive. You want to keep the cost of capital low, because if the system is seen as risky, Warren Buffett owns one of the major utilities in the United States, and there's a period in the United States in the 1990s where all the, you know, there's a big, utilities are kind of like, you know, lemons. One person says something and they all say it. And so the thing that was like, oh, we have to have 10% growth. Internet is doing 10% growth, we got to do 10% growth. And year over year, 10% growth. Listen, no utility ever grew at 10%. But all of a sudden, they all felt like their income had to grow at 10%. And Buffett made this very nice pronouncement. He said, well, frankly, he wants his electric utilities to be a good investment, not a great investment. That's why he invested in them. They're a bond. And so we have to think about that these systems are expensive. They're highly capital intensive. One of the issues in Germany was that the loss of capital in the traditional industries, which becomes very expensive for consumers. And in an economy like Australia, we had the same issue in New York, we could not afford for our utilities to become bad investments. And so and then also as we're investing in generation, in solar, anything, wind, right, you want to have predictability. So it's going to be very, very important as we make this transition that the financial markets see it very predictable. That's one of the things they talk about. You know, certitude, predictability around policy is very important for them. Then they can figure out their investment strategy. But uncertainty is what leads to capital strikes and change. And so the other piece then, and you've heard me, I think you've probably heard me say this, that's why this issue of affordability is so critical. Because public policymakers understand demand degradation, whether it's because people can't afford it, or because companies go elsewhere, or can't afford to expand, because energy is too expensive, is a bad thing. And that's what's going to cause governments to intervene, because it's a public good, and they almost have to, which is going to cause investors to get worried, which is going to cause them to raise their cost of capital. And so it all sort of starts to swirl, which is why the Finkel, again, turning back, his blueprint talks about certainty, predictability, and having a smooth transition. And I know that was his reason, but I'll add to it, because it's very important to keep this financial system also wanting to invest in this sector with a great deal of confidence that they know the rules of the road, and that they can therefore at least have managed risk outcomes. So those are sort of the way we see it. Our focus is obviously on the first two, but the others have to work in order for us to be able to do our job. So that's it for me, and I'm happy to answer any questions and anything else you might want to talk about. So thank you.
Questions. I think we'll have two, one coming up this side and one coming up the other. So,
what time's breakfast?
I go to bed at 9:30. Where are everyone doing? Let's keep all sleep.
Short.
Well,
yeah,
anytime, that's fine. I'm fine.
It'll not be.
Yes.
Will it be nice? Okay, questions?
Thanks for a brilliant talk. Trying to get back to your third point, you were talking about forecasting, and yes. You kind of hammered that point in how important it is to forecast. And you said you're thinking about collaborating with universities, looking at neural events. I thought I'd ask you, given that the events that EMU really care about are the extreme events, and given that neural nets are trained on data that you already have, given that our climate extremes might be changing, I'm seeing a problem that you can't quite train AI and neural nets to predict the 1 in 1,000 year event or 100 year event, but that's the one that you guys care about. So how on earth are we going to deal with that? I'd be really curious to hear your thoughts.
Well, I think that's a good question. So there's a couple of thoughts. One is, I don't know, how extreme the extreme events are anymore. So, take a look at what's happened in the last several weeks, right? 5 hurricanes hitting the Mid-Atlantic. Last summer, we had 45 degree days in Sydney, which is was pretty incredible. So part of what I think AEMO has to actually think about is uncertainty. So we can't, and we never will, and no operator ever can guarantee 100% outcome because things fall over, storms happen, and there are extreme days that if you're not going to build a power plant just because you might have this day in 1 in 30 years. But that's where I think demand can be very helpful. So I think one of the things that the skill set one of the skill sets we have to develop is managing uncertainty as opposed to managing predictability and what kind of capability and flexibility we need in our systems to manage through that uncertainty. And that's where I think these networks and these learning algorithms can do something. One of the things that when I was at PJM, we were a grid that was about 45,000 megawatts, and we grew from 45,000 megawatts to 162,000 megawatts. And so we had to figure out how we're going to learn to evolve through this capacity of all this uncertainty. We started working with Rockwell Automation, who does the rocket launches, to be able to help the operators so that an operator just can't look at all this stuff. And so we need these networks to sort of start helping the operators look at these configuration events and make a determination of what's important and what's not. It's not like they can sit at a screen and look at all the generators and the lights will flash when you think about all the things that are going on now. So it's really, I think, these smart systems that are going to be necessary for us and dealing with the uncertainties.
So question, Jeremy Burke, I was involved in setting up and running the UK Green Investment Bank, so I've seen a lot of you described a few years ahead of Australia. It was a great talk with a blend of innovation and incumbency. So I want to pick up 2 of the points of incumbency that you spoke of. A belief in wholesale markets, they're a pretty artificial construct that really there's limited substitution and they haven't actually brought on much new capacity. There's a thesis in the UK that they're just not going to survive and that we're going to end up with kind of regulated feed-in tariffs for renewables and then capacity markets for thermal, because you can't survive in South Australia if you're a thermal getting -$3 a megawatt like we saw the other day. So interested in whether you see wholesale markets surviving. And then the grid, which is ultimately a social asset, and you talked about it in that way, is there any way the grid can survive in private hands, or do we just need to jump to nationalising it because it's a social asset?
I'll try to unpack that. It's a happy thought. So one is I think the wholesale markets will survive. They need to get more, they have to get more complex, more granular, because I look at it this way. We have an energy-only market. In Australia, we don't have a capacity market like they do in parts of the U.S. When we designed the market, we were able to pay for energy only. And with that, we got frequency, we got voltage support, we got capacity, capability. But we didn't pay separately for it. because of the fact that we didn't need to. It sort of came with the kit, right? Now we have resources that provide zero margin energy, but they're not necessarily providing inertia or other resources. So we have to start unbundling, very much like we did in communication. We used to just pay for dial tone. I think there's probably a lot of people in this room who know what a dial tone is. So we have to think about, it's just an unbundling process of more discrete products that we will optimize as a system operator. But that means that if, for example, the generator is supplying reliability, they should get paid for that as a resource, because they're providing a capability, in other words, ability to respond, that needs to be monetized in the market. And then the other piece that we have to think about, this is where intervention, you know, needs to occur, is the sense of, if you have resources, you know, dropping in costs, and these are things that policymakers need, you know, think about, what's your transition plan? So I won't talk about Australia because it's not my role. I'll tell you what we did in New York, which was highly controversial, but I still think it was a good decision. We were 30% nuclear in New York. The governor had a goal to be at 50% renewables, but more importantly, had a goal to reduce his emissions. And we knew that if we allowed one of those nuclear plants to retire, because they were all losing money, without a subsidy, that every dollar we had spent on emission reduction in the last 30 years would be lost. And that more likelihood that nuclear plant is going to be replaced by new gas, which would be around for another 50 years. So we made it, this is what policymakers have to do. We made a determination it was cheaper to actually pay a subsidy for the nuclear plants to stay open until we got more renewables in the grid than to allow them to shut down, have to pay for a bunch of new gas, and have to pay again to reduce our emissions. And so those are the kind of things we need to think about in Australia, is what's this transition? And if there needs to be some support for existing resources, and I'm not saying there should be, that's the kind of thing that policymakers need to think about, as opposed to going out and building a new plant that is going to be around for a long time, but we may be missing the opportunity because the transition is occurring very quickly. So that's kind of this combination of things. Mm-hmm. On the grid itself, I don't think it should be government. I think it's fine to keep it in private hands. I don't think you're going to see a lot of competition in the system. In other words, there's still, I think, an economy of scale around distribution systems and transmission systems. And it's very hard to operate a system with multiple owners because it's truly real time. So I don't see any reason to socialize that. I think the markets can be more exciting. The other thing that's going to happen is what I call vertical coupling, which is that rather than markets just being the bulk power markets, now you're going to have just the retail markets. And they're going to be coupled, and they're going to have greater depth and variety. And so, you know, when you see people doing blockchain and really interesting transactive energy at the edge of the system, that's only going to happen if you have wholesale markets, because it's really a supply and demand equation, and demand is now much more efficient. So I think in the countries that don't have markets, they'll be slow to the game in this level of innovation that's happening at the grid edge.
Yes, I'm interested in the storage question. Apparently we have some hundreds of sites for small to medium pumped hydro that really could be turned on quickly. What will it take for these to happen in the short term?
That I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the price signals are. I know that's being looked at, and I certainly know from everything that the Prime Minister said that he sees this as a huge asset. So. I would think that it's the kind of thing we'd want to do, right? Which just gets to my point. We wouldn't want to just send a market signal if we're really, you know, if we had a combination of emissions goals along with price goals, is to take a look at these resources and figure out what kind of market design it's going to take to actually get them up and going. So I don't know the answer of what it would take. I know it should be looked at and see if it's not happening organically in the market to understand why.
Thank you, Roger, for your presentation. Now, I'm Swin, I'm a PhD student at the Australian German Climate and Energy College. And According to the recently published report from AIMO, saying that there are possibility, likelihood of the shortfall, power supply shortfalls around 26 to 40 something percent in South Australia and in in Victoria. If the unprecedented events occur in these two states, what are all the action plans and the contingency that you do in response to that?
So just to be clear, what we AIMO forecasted is that if we did nothing, we would have a risk. But we did not do nothing. We did a lot. So we've been working with all the generators and the transmission folks to make sure that they're ready. We've been making sure that there's fuel available. But we also have worked with ARENA and through our own reserve process. And so we created an innovative program around demand response, where we're also looking, in addition to that, 1,000 megawatts of emergency resources that we're also contracting for. And then in addition to that, South Australia is putting in a battery. They're putting in more generation. Victoria's putting in a battery. So all those, what we said was, if we had not taken the steps that we took to prepare for the summer, it was a risk, which is why we took the steps. So I feel like we're in good shape. Again, as an operator, I'm never going to say we're in perfect shape, and I can promise everybody nothing will happen. But I would be saying that if I were in Philadelphia at PJM too. Things happen. This is a real time system. Things break. Storms happen. Things like that. So you always have a risk of an outage, but we have sufficient resources to get us through even extreme days.
Thank you, Audrey, for your talk tonight. There's a lot of excitement in Australia from a lot of residents for residential battery. There's a lot of people talking about grid defection as well. I don't believe that grid defection is a good thing. There's a lot of solar on rooftops that once the batteries are full would be able to export that energy to the grid, which is a valuable resource. Would you say that it would be useful for all residential battery systems to have the ability to provide network services?
Yes. No, I don't think the idea that you're going to have a bunch of isolated systems, right? The value you have is really the integrated system. And the ability is to actually use these resources to manage an integrated system, make it more productive, is exactly what's so exciting. I think it would be a shame if people do grid defection and we think about that, because these things will break. And the other piece is you get more value because of diversity. And so one of the things I'm excited about is one of the areas that we're going to be exploring is the capability of creating these renewable sites, large scale renewable sites, with thinking about, are there places in the country where if you put the renewables, you can add transmission associated with it. It's when you get much higher value wind and much higher value solar, and think about how you interconnect that and drive value back to the system and take advantage of the sunsets at different times. You have different weather patterns, and you can move the energy better. So far from, I think distributed resources will have a value, probably a greater value than historically. But I think it's the integrated whole where we take advantage of, as I keep saying, just make the orchestra bigger, more instruments, and the music will get better. That's what we really want to do.
Can we hear from some of the women in the room?
Thank you. I wasn't going to ask a question, but after that invitation. My name's Andrea Bunting. Thank you for a fantastic talk. Very impressed that you've managed to get demand management on the agenda. And now I really have hope that something will happen this year. But we seem to have dropped the ball in Australia on energy efficiency. So we're having this whole conversation around energy prices and massive energy bills, and it's all around the supply side. So the demand side, in terms of demand side management, is great. But how do we also get that energy efficiency back on the agenda? Strong regulations from government, I think, is what required. As well as if there's anything that you could do to shift the agenda on that as well.
That's not what AMO's role to determine policy. But I'll just tell you, I think energy efficiency, obviously, the electron you don't use is the cheapest and probably the cleanest, so it's a good thing. I think, certainly if we can make the markets more vibrant around demand markets, there's an opportunity when people are putting in these resources, you are becoming necessarily more efficient and you become more energy aware. So the likelihood of being able to develop those markets for energy efficiency makes sense. But I as much as I would love to, it gets me in trouble when I step that far out of my path.
Good evening. Good evening. Can you hear me okay?
Is yes.
Good evening, Audrey. Welcome to Australia. The question I've got is something which has just come out of really left field. You mentioned where Australia, we could sort of export our technology to other countries for in solar or wind or whatever. Many years ago, our telecommunications company, Telstra, used to do that, go to a lot of third world countries and give their expertise and technology. Have you actually identified any Australian companies that can step into the breach and do that, or is it all AGLs and Elon Musks and Origin?
Certainly, I mean, there's a few things I see in the arena, like Greensync, PosiGen. I mean, there's some really fascinating companies. One is Curve. Watchers. But Charles, you have a bunch.
Yes.
Reposit. I mean, there are a lot of companies that are really doing fascinating things around this, and some really cool blockchain companies are looking at things. So I all that. Arena actually invested in a company that is now producing solar voltaic cells, the cheapest in the world, and they're being used everywhere. So I think there's a huge opportunity for Australia to lead. I think that one of the things that because of our just the way we're situated, there's a lot of the needs we have. I think are going to be the needs that we're leading the world in terms of penetration of solar and wind and that kind of stuff.
Hi. Sorry, I didn't realise it'd be. I think it's fair to say that one thing the national electricity market hasn't delivered is new transmission. And one of the things that my understanding of Finkel is that he was saying is that AMO should identify new transmission lines to connect renewables. I think a new line to South Australia would be a fantastic thing. It would basically make South Australia power reliable if a new interconnector was built. Has AMO got plans for looking at new transmission lines?
Yes, yeah, we do. So that is the regional planning role that we've been assuming under the Finkel. So it is to look at not just interregional but interstate, and Alan went to Texas, where he met with the folks there. They have something called the Prez Project, which, anyway, the Texas, what they did is they said, similar to a lot of places, solar and wind was all in West Texas. People lived in East Texas. So the government went and said, well, why don't we build a transmission line to move it? And it's that kind of things that you're seeing where we could be looking at these projects and identifying the best areas and then socialize it, make it better. But that's would be a few as well, something we would do with the transmission asset owners. And they're very, as you can imagine, anxious for us to get going on that.
James Brown from Monash University in our engineering area. I'm a traditional engineer, so, you know, investment.
And I'm a lawyer, and I just played an engineer my whole career.
I have played as an engineer, which may be a good or a bad thing. I'm very impressed by your talk, and one of the things I've been telling our students is that all sorts of things are coming in to the industry, in every industry, which will dramatically transform what's going on. But my particular hobby, of course, is what the previous speaker was saying about transmission. My back of the envelope calculation would indicate that you could put a major incremental investment of about $10 billion into major transmission. And the average cost per megawatt hour delivered would be only 2 or 3. It's trivial compared with the variations in market prices we've been seeing. And it does solve many problems. I mean, you don't have a market. We're running 5 separate markets. And you don't have a market if you can't transport commodities. And the east-west type time zone, the ability to put renewables where they're most cost-effective, really relies on transmission. It seems to be a fairly good path to go, but, you know, can you find groups that want to put up that money to build a regulated asset?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, I mean, yes, so I don't think that's going to be an issue. Historically, we've had a bias towards just allowing the market to solve issues. And the way I'm thinking about it is that, you know, we built the system by engineers who did load haul flows and all those things. It's not going to happen by accident, and as you know, it takes 10 years to build transmission if you're everything goes well. So it's going to have to be a planning activity around where are the best locations in the country to site these from overall economic, and then a process so that we get people to the table. But I have no know. We talk to the transmission owners. They very much like to be looking at that. We have some regulatory challenges to go through that we're going to have to go over. RIT-T is one, but I think we can. You know, with AIMA, this is where
get through RIT-T. Yes. Because the possibility. Well, you introduce the proper market, single market, so we don't have the manipulation of prices in markets that we're seeing at the moment.
So the example that I, you know, I took, totally agree. The example we did is when PJM, when we expanded the market, I mean, they're still not doing, they save about $22 billion a year off their energy costs simply because they're able to move power from Chicago to New Jersey. And so having these networks and strengthening the networks, first of all, make them more flexible so we'll be able to deal with issues better. Secondly, it allows for us to take advantage of diversity and make better use of assets. So I think one of the things that people saw in the States and is not talked about here as much is that for renewables, because renewables tend to be the best wind places and the best solar, tend to be further away from where people live, is that transmission, which used to be a dirty word, you know, people, when I was doing transmission in the 80s, you know, people would come over and knock over towers because it was all about importing coal. But now folks are realizing that actually you need these networks in order to help support the grid, support a zero carbon grid. So I think it's that mindset is changing.
Yeah,
And you can do things, you know, towers are no longer lattice anymore, they're not as ugly.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have to interrupt with sort of apologies. 2 questions ago, I was told we have 2 questions to go. I have this problem of multiple bosses. My ultimate boss is sat right in front of me as president of the ATA, so she is going to have the last question. And some time ago, on the other side of the room, there's a gentleman, Bernie, who was waving in a quite agitated sort of fashion. So if we may extend it to 2 more final questions, please. We'll let Bernie go first with a brief one, please, Bernie.
I'll try to do a brief answer.
Is network costs before you say, is there any way we can get efficiency in terms of network costs, in terms of the interaction we had before with the batteries, and still have better interaction network in terms of commercial
technology? Energy efficiency, you said?
No, network costs. Network costs.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of your question.
The high costs of network.
Right.
Basically, in terms of the input price down for them, and also still being a certainly for the actual networks. So I'd say, rather than the grid, it's a feedback from a few batteries to the grid.
Still not hearing your question.
So the network costs, the bulk of
costs.
What
costs do you have?
Sorry, I've got a new call. So the network costs are considerable. So how do we bring those costs down?
So I think that there's a few things we can do. One is looking at how you use demand resources better. So sort of looking at what people call non-wire alternatives. So if you can use demand-based resources better, an example, we did in New York where we avoided building a substation in Brooklyn by using things, batteries and solar is better. There's one way, because if you don't need to build these networks with the right incentives, you can get there. But I also think, that there's this sort of fear, this thing about gold plating. Well, gold plating is like, to me, is different than building resources to drive down your total bill. And I look at it as that what we have to start thinking about is that consumers pay for the total bill. It's cheaper for a consumer to build an interconnection to make better use of the solar and wind than duplicating resources, then we should be looking at that. And so I think that the answer is we shouldn't be fearful of the question. Our goal is to actually drive the best outcome for consumers, and if that means investing in networks rather than generation, that's great. The regulator needs to make sure that the process that is used, and you can use competitive processes around that, is that the outcome is the cheapest, but that the investment that's made is the one that creates the best outcome. So I would separate a regulatory issue from a design and planning issue.
Okay, Helen Dillis was the final question. And thank you for that. If I may impose upon you to progress this issue, because we have in Victoria smart meters at homes and the premises. We have the capacity to do far more around energy efficiency on site. And one of the major challenges that we have is obviously the supply of the pricing that we have. I know it may not be your key area of concern, but surely with around pricing systems, regulations, incentives and requirements, even be as a white certificate scheme for investment by energy companies into efficiencies, into businesses, into homes, there must be ways we can integrate this and progress this. What would you say would be some of the key priority actions that we should take as a priority in Australia, if not here in Victoria, in addition to what, for example, the Victorian government is doing with the Energy Jobs Fund and other sorts of initiatives, what would you say would be the key way to progress energy efficiency?
I think that one is certainly what you've said before, some of these upstream folks. I mean, it's amazing when you change codes and requirements and how that can drive with people. So I think that I'm not sure what the codes are here, but building codes, you know, the different programs around that can be helpful. Certainly appliance codes, all those white good kind of things. efficiencies, requirements around that will drive change because manufacturers will respond to that. So that's a, you know, that's something that universally I think the cities, smart cities, which I know Melbourne is part of, can start driving that. So they will change the manufacturers if the cities get sustainable cities start talking about where they want the efficiencies of these goods to go. And that'll take time because people don't buy refrigerators and air conditioners and things regularly. Certainly tightening the buildings would be helpful. I think one of the things that, you know, this is personally, as a regulator, I always feel like targets are really helpful. One of my snarkier comments, which I didn't make up, but people have used, is that, you know, people, there's nice ways to say, all regulation is incentive regulation, you're just incenting different behavior. One of my favorite utility executives said all utilities are like rats in a maze and go after the cheese, you move the cheese, they'll figure it out. So if you set targets, goals, they'll get there. And I think one of the things that's not talked about is just what's the market potential. How do we set a target towards that and then design our programs towards achieving those targets? So I would say having that real discussion about what, and then what we can provide, of course, at AEMO, is, well, what's the alternative? If we're able to take reduced demand by 10%, 15%, 20%, how will that affect what we need to do in the market and therefore affect price? And that maybe is a role we could play is sort of modeling in
yes.
different levels of efficiency so that policymakers understand the trade-offs of making. Well, thank you all. It's been a pleasure.
About the action on climate change policy and what's led to our energy market and the lack of reform over the last 10 years. So it's something that we work on quite a lot at the ATA. But for people who have been in this sector for working for many years, I must say that I listen to the news, I get very angry at times and frustrated that things aren't moving. But after having our Sustainable House Day on the weekend, when we had 20,000 people turning up, and the enthusiasm out there in the community for that transition is quite amazing, and it's happening, and people are actually enjoying it. So we had houses across the country open from all electric homes, ones with electric vehicles, ones with heat pumps. But what we really always push is just good old energy efficiency, and that's something that we want to keep pushing at the ATA as well. Just a couple of things to give you an update that we're working on at the moment that might be of interest to people. One, at the moment, we're updating our gas versus solar economic modeling and research that we first conducted about 2 years ago. This was a real game shifter in looking at the economics of households shifting to all electric homes and also their carbon emission savings from that. And we'll be releasing that new modeling in a couple of months, something like that, Dean. Yes. The other work that we're working on, and it comes from a bit of this transition as well, is looking at consumer protections in this changing market. So we talked about some of those innovative new companies coming through, which we work a lot with. So at the moment, you know, with different types of working, like embedded networks and other possibilities into the future, consumer protections will fall out of the normal national energy market at the moment. So we want to make sure consumers are protected. But also, we want to make sure that those consumer protections doesn't slow down any transitions of these companies as well. So it's another area we've been working on. And third is batteries, of course. People cannot get enough about batteries, and we get questions all the time. And I feel we spend half our time, people coming to us talking about batteries, and going, no, you shouldn't go off the grid, stay on the grid. The grid is a good thing. Put your excess solar back into the grid. But we actually start having a conversation with people going, well, let's look at your energy efficiency first. Then looks at your solar, and then let's start playing for battery storage as well. So for us, there's a lot of issues that Audrey talked about, that we're talking to consumers all the time, and at the ATA, our role is to provide that independent advice to consumers as well. So I just need to do the thank yous, and I'll just swap this over here, and someone will pass me these up. Thank you. So Audrey, we'd like to say thank you. We know you are a very busy person, and we've one, given you an ATA membership, but the second thing is our favourite. The other thing is our favourite thing, it's called the Lukey light. So it's this solar powered light that you can blow up, and I keep this within my back garden, so when I go outside and they get things from the gardens, it's always there for me. So these will always be there when the lights do go off, they'll be there. Any other questions about the ATA and other work we are doing, please go to our website, and thank you all for coming along.